This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by HP Print Studio. Express your brand with HP Print Studio. Find free customized templates to build your business identity, like letterhead, business cards, and shipping labels. Start the journey at www.hp.ca/print.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
E is equal to mc squared, in which
the
energy is
all spent for man. But
the human genome is our shared inheritance, and it is sitting at the top of the
cracks and cracks.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Look up, Canada. See that bright yellow disc in the sky? It's been hidden from us for a while, but now it's time to get out and soak up some sunshine. You'll enjoy it, of course, but more importantly, your body will be using it. Using it to make something vital to our health, vitamin D. There's a lot of excitement about vitamin D these days, as new research is showing its potential for a whole range of health benefits, from cancer prevention to stopping infections. We've got the essential information on this essential nutrient today. Plus, we'll hear about a frog whose bony claws may do as much damage to itself as to its foes. And we've got a fossilized, pregnant 300-million-year-old fish that's changed our view of early sex in the seas. And finally, we'll hear about how looking good can really make you feel good, especially if you're a barn swallow. But first, it's a new dawn for the sunshine vitamin. This is Quirks and Quarks. Ah, summer, it's finally here, or at least it's almost here, and with it, the sun. Every year, about this time, I get my sailboat ready, eagerly anticipating the first outing of the season. The only thing that beats watching the mainsail fill with the breeze is that wonderful feeling of the sun on my back. After all, there's nothing quite as revitalizing as soaking up the sun and replenishing the old vitamin D stores after several months of cold, dark misery. And getting a healthy dose of the sunshine vitamin not only feels good, but it turns out it's pretty important for our health. After all, it's well known that vitamin D is essential to building and maintaining a healthy skeleton. But if you've been paying attention to the buzz in the medical community, you might be aware that there's strong evidence that vitamin D is much more important than that. In fact, many researchers are convinced that a better understanding of the value of vitamin D in many areas of health could be one of the most important medical discoveries in recent time. But don't just take my word for it.
My name is John Cannell. I'm a practicing physician in the United States. I work at a Tascadero State Hospital here in California. There's an enormous amount of research that's going on about vitamin D in cancer, vitamin D in diabetes, vitamin D in asthma, vitamin D in autism, vitamin D in depression, vitamin D in multiple sclerosis, vitamin D in hypertension. I mean, the list is almost endless. We're talking about a revolution here, and we're not talking about some supplement formulation that's some huckster is talking to you about on television. This is a substance that you can obtain for free in the summertime. Vitamin D supplements are cheap, available at any pharmacy or over the internet. This is a substance that, in my opinion, is going to revolutionize medicine. The implications are just astounding.
Now, this may sound a little bit like a late-night infomercial, but Dr. Cannell isn't alone. A growing number of researchers hold a lot of hope for the sunshine vitamin's potential based on some very promising science. This enthusiasm is tempered by the fact that much of this research is still in its infancy, so at this point there's more tantalizing promise than solid evidence. But nevertheless, that promise is enormous. So today we're going to look at exactly what scientists do know about vitamin D and how they're looking at the sunshine vitamin in a whole new light. But first, let's start with some basics. What exactly is vitamin D? Well, vitamins are simply nutrients we need to stay healthy, and we get nearly all of them from our food. But this is where vitamin D is a bit of an odd duck. We do get small amounts of it in certain foods, like eggs and fatty fish, but not very much. Generally, not anywhere close to meet the recommended daily requirement of 200 international units. In fact, you'd have to eat about 10 eggs a day to get that much. That's why many foods like milk and breakfast cereal are fortified with vitamin D. There are other sources. If you're of a certain age, you may have been force-fed cod liver oil as a kid. Your mom wasn't just being a meanie. Nasty as it is, a spoonful of cod liver oil has about 400 units, or about 20 eggs worth of vitamin D in it. These days, it's more common to simply take a vitamin D pill. And if you've ever tasted cod liver oil, you'll understand why. But the most straightforward way of getting enough is also the most enjoyable. Simply go outside and take advantage of the high-efficiency vitamin D factory you're wearing, your skin. After all, vitamin D is the only vitamin our bodies can actually produce. When ultraviolet light hits your hide, the vitamin D factory kicks things into high gear. Dr. Cannell.
If you put on your bathing suit and you go outside in the summertime around solar noon and sunbathe for 15, 30 minutes, you make 20,000 units of vitamin D in about 20 minutes. Now, I asked myself, I thought about that for a long time because the government recommends 200 units for people under the age of 50, even pregnant women. And I asked myself, now, if nature is making 20,000 units in 20 minutes and the government tells you 200 units, first question is, who do you want to believe, the government or nature? And the second question is, why would humans develop with a system that made that much vitamin D that quickly? And the only answer I could come up with is that the body needs it, and it's desperately trying to make it when it has the opportunity.
Interestingly, while we've known for decades that the skin makes this huge amount of vitamin D when exposed to sunshine, we don't know exactly what the body does with it all. It's well established that it's vital for keeping our bones healthy. Vitamin D molecules in your blood fit into special receptors in your intestinal cells, kind of like how a car key fits into the ignition. And just like starting a car, once it's in the cell, it turns on some pretty complicated biological machinery. The cells in your intestine rev up and pull calcium from the food you eat. The end result? More calcium circulating in your blood, and down the road, more calcium in your bones. But we also know you only need a relatively small amount of vitamin D to do this, way less than what your skin makes when you're out in the sun. One of the first hints that this excess of vitamin D from your skin might have other functions has just come in the last few years. Researchers realized that vitamin D receptors aren't just limited to the cells lining your intestines. Dr. Cannell.
It was thought, really up until 10 years ago, I mean, most people simply thought of vitamin D as the thing that is involved with bone, either rickets in childhood or osteomalacia, osteoporosis in adults. And in the last 10 years, what's happened is people have discovered that the mechanism to activate vitamin D, to turn it from the precursor vitamin D into the steroid hormone activated vitamin D, that machinery is present in a wide variety of human tissues, in fact, almost all human tissues. And that opened up the possibility then that vitamin D was involved in much more than just bone disease.
It's kind of like discovering that your car key also starts all the other cars on your street. The idea is that vitamin D might act like a skeleton key that can activate biological machinery in cells almost everywhere in our body. So while we've been focused on getting enough of the sunshine vitamin to maintain healthy bones, we may have been missing out on the bigger picture. This new perspective has ushered in a new era in vitamin D research. One important example is cancer. Now, we tend to associate too much sun with skin cancer, but ironically, it seems that the sunshine vitamin might actually protect us from certain other forms of cancer.
My name is John White. I have a PhD in biochemistry, and I'm now a professor in the departments of physiology and medicine at McGill University. And I study the molecular mechanisms of action of vitamin D. If I wanted to put a fixed date on the modern era, it might be a paper that was published in 1980 by the Garland brothers, who made an observation that rates of cancer, particularly colon cancer, increased as you went north. And they opened up the notion that maybe this has something to do with sunlight, and that given that vitamin D can be produced in the skin by sunlight, that maybe it was the active ingredient here was vitamin D. And the reason that you got elevated rates of cancer in northern locations was simply that people were not producing as much vitamin D.
As promising as this line of reasoning is, it leaves a lot of unanswered questions. Sure, it makes sense that the closer to the equator you are, the more ultraviolet light you get, and the higher the vitamin D levels in your blood. But this doesn't necessarily mean that vitamin D is the good guy. There are plenty of other things that go along with living in tropical latitudes that might explain lower cancer rates. Diet, exercise, genetics, just to name a few. Researchers are just starting to get a clearer picture of the vitamin D cancer connection. Another promising area is breast cancer. Dr. Pam Goodwin is a breast cancer specialist at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. She spent the last 20 years looking at the various risk factors behind breast cancer, from obesity to a family history of the disease. More recently, she's begun looking at vitamin D levels.
We have a cohort of over 500 women who've been participating in our research for a large number of years. And those women had provided blood to us when they were diagnosed between 10 and 15 years ago. And we analyzed those blood specimens for vitamin D. And what we found was that vitamin D deficiency was very common, which is not a surprise. Vitamin D deficiency is common in the general population. 37% of women were deficient, and another 38% had levels that were insufficient. Only about a quarter had levels that were in the healthy range. And then when we looked at what vitamin D predicted in terms of breast cancer, we found that the vitamin D deficient women had high-grade or aggressive tumors, and that the vitamin D deficient women had an almost doubled risk of distant recurrence, so spread through the body, and they had an almost 75% relative increase in the risk of death.
Dr. Goodwin's study suggests that vitamin D may help women fight off breast cancer once they already have it. And there have been similar studies suggesting that people with higher levels of vitamin D may have a lower risk of developing certain forms of cancer in the first place, particularly colon and prostate cancer. Still, Dr. Goodwin warns against jumping to conclusions.
Well, I think that cancer is a complex disease, and no one factor is going to cause most cancers, and no one factor is going to be responsible for the outcome. When it comes to breast cancer and breast cancer outcomes, vitamin D may play a role, but it's early days in the research, and I think that we need to be careful before we start telling all women with breast cancer that taking vitamin D will absolutely lower their risk of recurrence.
Dr. Goodwin says the only way to be certain that vitamin D fights cancer is to run large-scale clinical trials, like the ones used to test new drugs. Some researchers have actually started to do this, giving one group of people vitamin D supplements and comparing them to people who don't take them. One recent study found that people who took 1,000 units of vitamin D a day had 75% less chance of developing cancer 4 years down the road. These results have created quite a buzz, but we'll clearly need more and longer trials like that before we can definitely say vitamin D is a cancer fighter. But while those clinical trials are happening, other researchers who study the basic biology of cancer cells are working on trying to understand the nuts and bolts of just what vitamin D might be doing to help prevent or slow down cancer. Dr. Cannell.
Vitamin D makes your cells die when they're supposed to. That's called apoptosis. And people think, well, I don't want my cells to die. Well, actually you do, because one of the things that cancer cells do is they won't die when they're supposed to. So vitamin D forces apoptosis to occur when it's supposed to. The second thing that it does is it also forces specialization of cells. Cancer cells are not specialized. They're not differentiated into the types of cells they're supposed to be in many cases. But vitamin D forces differentiation. It forces the cell to become this kind of cell it's supposed to be. Vitamin D also prevents what's called angioneogenesis. That's new blood vessels. Cancers hijack your arterial system and take the blood that isn't that they want, so that the tumor cells can grow. And vitamin D helps prevent that.
Cancer, however, isn't the only disease that researchers think might be interesting to look at in the light of the sunshine vitamin. Dr. John White at McGill University has been investigating how vitamin D seems to help our immune system fight off certain infections.
We grew cells in tissue culture, and we treated them with vitamin D, and we took portions of the tissue culture media over time, and we showed that that tissue culture media acquired the capacity to kill bacteria with increasing time of vitamin D treatment. And, you know, we were able to show that there was activity produced against laboratory E. coli, but also against a pathogen called Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is responsible for a bacterial infection, for example, that takes place in the lungs of patients with cystic fibrosis. So we were able to show that we generated activity against clinically relevant bacterial species. This was one of my eureka moments when we started to get these kinds of results.
Other researchers have found that vitamin D kicks our immune cells into high gear, stimulating them to kill off certain microbes, including bacteria that cause tuberculosis. This is kind of interesting because it sheds some light on why the old-fashioned treatment for TB, exposing patients to sunlight, helped fight off the disease. So there's plenty of tantalizing evidence that vitamin D is doing a whole lot more than just building healthy bones. Its potential as an anti-cancer agent and as an immune system booster are both fascinating. But what about the claims that vitamin D also protects against other diseases? Well, this is where the research gets a little muddy. Take multiple sclerosis, for example. There's plenty of evidence that there are more cases of MS the further from the equator you get. And MS tends to flare up in the winter when your body makes less vitamin D and gets better in the summer when there's more. The same pattern is true for juvenile diabetes, Crohn's disease, autism, and asthma. But while it's tempting to jump whole hog on the vitamin D bandwagon, there are hundreds of other possible things that could explain this pattern. Things like genetics and diet. So it's likely going to take a long time before we untangle whether vitamin D has anything to do with these diseases. So exactly where does this leave us? If vitamin D looks so promising, shouldn't we all just start tossing back fistfuls of the stuff just to be on the safe side? And if so, just how much should we be taking? Well, this is the subject of some pretty intense debate. The official word from Health Canada is that everyone needs about 200 international units of vitamin D per day. If you're over 50, you might consider taking an additional 400 units. But here's the catch. These guidelines are based on what we need for healthy bones. A number of researchers think that for many reasons this is far too low. Dr. Reinhold Veith is a clinical biochemist at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He says there isn't a lot of logic to Health Canada's lowball recommendation.
The teaspoonful of cod liver oil that was discovered 200 years ago to help infants thrive and prevent rickets, that contains about 400 units, and that's the same number that the Canadian Pediatric Society recommends for all infants, except those infants in the north, 800 units for those in the north. So 400 works just through long history of experience to prevent rickets in babies, but recognize, you know, you as an adult are 10 times the size of a baby. So you as an adult should be taking a decent increase in your dose compared to whatever an infant is getting, not half that infant recommendation. So that our current guidelines are, when you think about it, I would hate to use this word, but insane. They make no sense whatsoever.
Dr. Veith isn't alone in his frustration. As he mentioned, the Canadian Pediatric Association's recommendation for kids is higher than Health Canada's recommendation for adults. In fact, the Pediatric Association recommends nursing women take 10 times Health Canada's recommendation for vitamin D, up to 2,000 units. And the Canadian Cancer Society's official recommendation for adults is 1,000 units per day. But if vitamin D is so important that we all ought to be taking supplements, it raises the question, why aren't we naturally getting more in the first place? Well, Dr. Veith argues that we've got a mismatch between our environment and our evolutionary history.
Humans are the naked ape that originated and developed its biology at latitudes south of Florida. So if you picture the human being as a naked ape in equatorial latitudes, it means that that full factory, our skin that is making vitamin D, when you move northwards, basically that factory starts to shut down. You don't have as much vitamin D produced. The cells don't quite act as optimally. And unfortunately, we've always been living in kind of a vitamin D deprived environment and kind of wondering about it. It's almost like if you had an air conditioner on in a room and somebody suddenly clicked it off and you go, oh, sounds different. Something's going on here. Well, I think with the vitamin D scenario, you know, we're all living in a relatively vitamin D deprived state and only now starting to even wonder whether it's making a difference.
The idea is that ever since our ancestors moved out of Africa and headed for the poles, we haven't been getting the vitamin D our bodies need. The fact that we're now spending more time indoors than ever before probably doesn't help either. Even if you're an avid outdoor type, living north of the 49th parallel means you're inevitably starving for the sunshine vitamin for a good part of the year. Dr. White.
I think the notion that vitamin D, either insufficiency or deficiency, is fairly widespread in sort of Canadian populations, Northern European populations, there's a fair amount of evidence at several levels for that. We have this concept of so-called vitamin D winter. The ultraviolet light that is necessary to produce vitamin D is in fact absorbed by the ozone layer in the atmosphere. And if the sun is relatively low in the sky, essentially all of the ultraviolet light necessary is absorbed before it gets to the ground. So you can stand outside in the sun for an extended period of time and you will not generate any vitamin D in the skin. And for example, I'm talking to you in Montreal. In the area of Montreal, this so-called vitamin D winter lasts for about 6 months. So for 6 months of the year, you know, you're not going to generate much vitamin D in your skin from sunlight at all. I'm sure that people can take 2,000 units a day quite safely without any adverse effects. I take 4,000 units a day for about 7 or 8 months of the year.
Now, that's not to say you should necessarily be following Dr. White's example. Whatever its beneficial effects, there can be too much of a good thing. Vitamin D can be quite toxic at very high doses. It can even be lethal. Although you do have to work pretty hard to poison yourself with the stuff. Dr. Veith says you'd have to choke back somewhere in the range of 40,000 units, 100 vitamin D pills every day for several weeks before you ran into trouble. But there are still a number of researchers who are cautious about taking much more than what Health Canada currently recommends until we see much more and better evidence. Dr. Goodwin, for one, warns against premature faith in a substance we don't yet fully understand.
When it comes to vitamin D, I think we need to be cautious. We've been in this situation before with other vitamins. 10 or 15 years ago, we had a lot of epidemiologic evidence that indicated that beta-carotene use or beta-carotene levels in smokers, if they were high, would help to prevent lung cancer. And everyone thought that was pretty strong evidence, but two or three groups of researchers said, let's be very careful here, and they did randomized trials where they supplemented beta-carotene or not in smokers. And what they found was not only did beta-carotene supplements not help, they actually increased the risk of lung cancer. My concern is, in relation to our data, that women with breast cancer may think that it's good to take very large doses of vitamin D. If a small amount is good, a large amount must be better, and that they may possibly take too much.
Dr. Goodwin's caution is understandable, but overall there seems to be fairly widespread agreement that we probably need more of the sunshine vitamin than we're currently getting. Even Health Canada is reconsidering its own advice. It says it will begin reviewing its current recommendations as early as this fall, largely because the new research is so compelling. And there's another good reason to review its recommendations: our changing population. The amounts of vitamin D Health Canada suggests are based on the requirements for light-skinned people, left over from the 1960s when these recommendations were originally made. But of course, Canada has now far more people with dark skin. And this is significant when it comes to vitamin D. People with dark skin make less vitamin D from sunlight. And when they find themselves in these sun-deprived high latitudes, they're even more likely to have low vitamin D levels. Of course, if you don't want to wait around for a new set of recommendations from Health Canada, and you're not crazy about taking vitamin D pills, or worse, cod liver oil, there's always the surefire way to make sure you're getting enough of the sunshine vitamin, at least while the good weather lasts. Pour yourself a cold one. put on your sunglasses, and soak up a little sun. Just make sure you don't burn. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks, the national science program, heard every Saturday afternoon and Monday evening across Canada on CBC Radio 1. We're live on the internet at cbc.ca, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and on various public radio stations throughout the U.S. Coming up next, fearsome froggy fingernails. Dr. David Blackburn has spent several field seasons in Africa studying rare and new frog species there. But it's likely nothing surprised him quite so much as the day when he picked up a large frog and ended up with deep and painful scratches. Apart from the shock and pain, this aroused a certain curiosity, like, how the heck did that happen? You see, unlike cats, dogs, humans, and other animals, frogs aren't supposed to have claws. Their webbed toes ordinarily end in just skin. Investigating just what was going on with this frog has led Dr. Blackburn to a fascinating and disturbing discovery about just how certain frogs defend themselves. Dr. Blackburn is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. Hi, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you very much.
Let's go back to that day in Africa. Tell me what happened.
At the time, I was doing field work in Cameroon. It was my very first field season, actually, as a graduate student. And I was in the mountains in the Southwest province, and we just, as part of our normal field work, go around collecting animals. And I picked up a large female hairy frog, this is the genus Trichopatrachus, and suddenly got a nasty scratch on my hand, and it was because the female just started kicking her feet wildly when I picked her up.
So what was your reaction when this frog scratched you?
Well, I probably can't say that on air, actually, but it was surprising, to say the least. It's actually hard. You spend so much time in the field picking up frogs. You know, you have sort of a general expectation when you pick up a frog that it's not going to harm you or bite you or anything like that. Usually, when you're out catching frogs, it's sort of and salamanders, it's sort of a gentleman's type sport. You know, you don't have to worry about getting scratched or bitten or harmed. In any way. So it was certainly a surprise to pick up a frog and all of a sudden get a really nasty scratch. And I guess my first instinct was to think, well, that surely couldn't have been the frog.
How nasty.
Surely there must have been something else that happened there. But
you picked up something with the frog, the idea. Yeah. Well, what's going on here? Because frogs aren't supposed to have claws. How did you figure out what
was happening? It's pretty surprising. So there are actually a few amphibians that have what we would think of as claws, but these are not known to harm anybody, and the function of them remains to be seen. However, what's happening in this one group of frogs that we studied is they don't have a nail or a claw that you would think of as a cat claw or a bird talon or something like that. Instead, it's simply the last bone of the finger actually is able to pierce through its skin and come out. Now, normally, tetrapods, so birds, mammals, reptiles, they do a pretty good job of actually keeping their bones in their fingers. This is not a common occurrence. It's actually completely unknown of other than in this one group of frogs.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying that the frog is sticking its bone through the end of its finger, and that's what the claw is.
It's actually kind of bizarre. It's something that you would probably not want to happen to yourself. So, yes, it's really striking. So if you look at one of these toes and the bone has actually not punctured through the skin, it looks pretty much like an ordinary frog toe, if you've ever looked at a frog toe, I guess.
I haven't seen one recently.
Well, if you're out in the field next time.
Okay.
They look pretty ordinary. However, when this bone is flexed with respect to the rest of the finger, rather than actually flexing the digit tip, this bone can puncture through the skin. It punctures through the underside, so the ventral surface of the digit tip. And the way it does this is it's what we think of as claw-shaped. It's recurved. It comes to a really strong point. The tip is actually reinforced with bone. And what we think happens is that when this bone is flexed, it's sharp enough that it breaks free from some specialized anatomy within the digit tip and actually just punctures right through the bottom of the finger – or bottom of the toe, rather.
This reminds me of the character in a science fiction movie who has the blades that come out of his hands. What is it, Wolverine?
Wolverine.
Yeah.
And he's actually Canadian, I believe, in the comic books. Yeah, so it is surprisingly similar, although I should point out that these frogs have a one-up on Wolverine because it's actually their skeleton that pops out rather than sort of a metal superficial skeleton that comes out.
Well, this sounds like it would hurt the frog. I mean, how is it able to do this?
Well, that's a really interesting question. A lot remains to be seen about essentially the biology of this. So when I've handled these frogs in the field myself, and you can definitely see the claws emerge and go in and out of the toes, it's not completely clear whether or not when they go back into the toes, if that's passive or active retraction. Cats, for instance, have passive retraction. But it's also not clear what happens after the claws come out. It does not appear that it causes the frogs to bleed, for instance. I've never seen any blood on the toe tips other than perhaps my own blood if they've scratched my hand.
Well, what happens when the claws go back in? Does it leave a hole
in
the skin?
Well, so that's actually the really interesting part. So those of us perhaps inspired by Marvel Comics Wolverine would like to think perhaps the wounds could actually regenerate and that the tissue surrounding the digit could actually heal again. And thus, the frog would essentially go back to looking like normal. This is something that we've really been interested in, and we've been trying to get some animals to experiment with in the lab. I mean, it's a very simple experiment. When you handle these frogs, the claws come out. They scratch you. We believe that this is, in fact, a defensive mechanism. But it's unclear what happens afterwards. And so what we'd like to do is just simply get them in the lab, have them erect their claws, and then let them be. Let them be for maybe, you know, a month, something like that, and then see whether or not that tissue is actually regenerated around the claw. But at the moment, we've just been working with museum specimens because that's pretty much all we can get our hands on for the most part of some of these rare frogs.
Well, what happened to the one that scratched you?
Well, it became a museum specimen.
Oh.
It's actually true. So doing experiments like this in the field are also kind of difficult because then you have to have some of these frogs kept alive for, you know, a month or something like that in the field and see whether or not it regenerates. And that's sort of a tricky thing, trying to keep some of these rare frogs in captivity.
Well, what about things like infections if they're actually piercing the skin with their bones?
So this is another really interesting question. So when we did histology, so when we did thin sections through the tips of some of these toes, one thing that we kind of expected to see was in the very few specimens where a claw actually had not yet emerged, so it was essentially the digit tip was whole, maybe we'll see some sort of place that sort of looks as if the claw would pass through it, essentially maybe a weak spot in the skin. And we didn't find anything like that. These wounds really look traumatic. The claw really sort of busts right out and tears a nice little gash in the end of the tip. The problem is, of course, we really know so little about the natural history of these animals, it's impossible to say with what frequency over the course of the animal's life they actually use these claws. My guess would be if these really are causing a traumatic wound, which thus make them susceptible to infection, maybe these are sort of a last resort defense.
So when do you think you'll have a chance to get your hands on a live specimen, not get scratched, and keep it alive long enough to see what happens to its toes?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm hoping in the next year or two. We actually have, as you might guess, quite a bit of interest in this now. And I'm hoping within the next year or two we might be able to procure a few specimens through the pet trade to actually test some of these hypotheses.
Dr. Blackburn, thank you very much, and good luck in your search.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob.
Dr. David Blackburn is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University. His work was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. Coming up next, an inside job. You've probably never stopped to consider it, but the Devonian was a pretty important period in evolutionary history. Now, admittedly, there certainly wasn't much happening on land almost 400 million years ago, but the seas were a busy place, full of a vast diversity of fish and sharks and other creatures. And the sea creatures were busily creating a fabulous range of evolutionary innovations, some of which are essential to life today. Dr. John Long, a paleontologist with the Museum Victoria in Melbourne, Australia, has discovered one of these innovations. He studies a type of Devonian fish called a placoderm, and he's found that when placoderms ruled the seas, these now extinct fish invented an important reproductive strategy we and many other animals have been using ever since. Dr. Long, welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
It's my pleasure, Bob.
Oh, tell me about these fish. What do they look like?
Well, placoderms were armor-plated primitive fish. Imagine a shark that had thick bony plates covering the head and the front part of the body, and that's pretty well much what a placoderm would have looked like.
Plates? What do you mean?
Well, dermal plates made of thick bone, sort of like plated armor, a bit like, I suppose, an armadillo or a crocodile has scutes on its back. They're just normal bones that you get in a regular fish today, except they were very thick and they sort of overlapped to form a sort of an armor around the front of the fish.
How big were these animals?
Well, the average placoderm was about, 30, 40 centimetres long, but the really biggest ones reached 6 or 7 metres in length, and they were the world's first true mega predators.
Holy smokes, they were that big and armoured. Sound like they were pretty formidable.
Absolutely. And placoderms were the lords of the seas, rivers and lakes for some 70 million years of Earth history. I mean, we think of things like, the dinosaurs ruled the planet for 160 million years. But, for the whole of the Devonian period, placoderms were the most abundant, most diverse and predominantly the in-your-face fish that were there all around the whole world.
Well, tell me about your discovery. What did you find recently?
Okay, well, this is a great story because it involves both a recent discovery from our last GOGO expedition in 2005 and a fish I found on my very first expedition in 1986, 22 years ago. But let me tell you about the first one. So my co-authors and I were studying this particular specimen and we were going to just describe it as another new species of placoderm when we got right to the end and the tail was still in the rock. We'd prepared out the bones of the head and the trunk and, we could determine from its proportions and its shape and its tooth plates that it was clearly a new genus that we'd have to name. But then we got to the tail and I said to Kate Trinajdzic, my co-author, let's put it in acid just one more time and so we can clarify the numbers of vertebrae and, those sort of details, mundane sort of statistical details, if you like. And so we put it in acid one more time and the next day I pulled it out, put it under the microscope, and I was just totally gobsmacked. I was stunned silent for a while, and then I started swearing a little bit. And then Kate said, what's the matter? What's happening? And I said, Kate, we've just found something really big. I said, I'm staring at what is the world's oldest fossil embryo, because there, nestled in the bones of the tail of the adult, was the complete little skeleton of a tiny unborn juvenile. And we saw the upper and lower jaws still articulated and a scattering of little embryonic plates. And then there was this strange white squiggly object, mineralized object, coming out and wrapping around it, which at the time we couldn't figure out what it was. But Kate examined that and put it on a piece under the electron microscope and emailed me a few days later saying she believed it's an umbilical cord. So here we have the world's first fossilized umbilical cord or maternal feeding structure found in any fossil in the history of paleontology and the first unborn embryos of placoderms, a group, an entire class of vertebrates which previously we had no data whatsoever about their reproductive biology. So it really was an amazingly big discovery for us.
Well, once you realized that you had an embryo inside one of these fish, what did that tell you about its reproductive strategy?
Well, the first thing is that they're the only group of placoderms that do show males having these bony claspers in the pelvic region and females lacking them having smooth pelvic plates. So because of that, we've long suspected that they may have had internal fertilization, but we've never had any evidence until this discovery. So this actually confirms that the claspers were used for internal fertilization, true sex in the sense of the word, rather than simply spawning in the water. But even more importantly was the fact that we made a second discovery. And this is one of those great stories in science where you make a mistake and you get to correct your own mistake 10 or 15 years later before somebody else has picked you up on it. So let's go back to 1986, my very first expedition to the Gogo cattle station. I was fairly young and green at the time, and I basically collected a load of these fish, brought them back to my lab at the University in Western Australia, and one of the very first specimens I prepared was one of these ptyctodont fish. Anyway, when I described this fish in 1995, I saw these clusters of scales along the body of this placoderm, which I renamed as Ostroptyctodus. And at the time, I didn't think anything of it. It's just, you know, the head was the interesting bit and the body was just boring. So once we found this new specimen, we knew what embryos in these placoderms actually look like. So we went back and I examined this fish again. And lo and behold, those little clusters of scales along the body turned out to be three perfect embryos, absolutely perfect little clusters of tiny skeletal bones. So that proved that this group of placoderms definitely had internal fertilization, and they could have up to triplets or maybe even up to four young at a time.
Wow, so you have not only one specimen, but now you've got two that you didn't even know you had.
And now we're going back looking at others. We're finding some more as well, but I won't talk about them just yet because that's our next paper.
Ah, okay. Well, how do you know that these little fish inside the bigger fish are embryos and not something that the big fish ate?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and it's obviously the first thing we thought of. That in previous papers published on Gogo fish, they'd found clusters of small plates in some of the others, and they thought, they're just cannibalizing their young or eating the young of other fish. It was clear that these particular ptyctodonts have very specialized tooth plates, very unusual and distinctive tooth plates. And the juvenile tooth plates were perfectly identical with the adult. So we knew that it was the same species based on the tooth plate morphology. Second was the position within the mother. Normally, if it's in the gut is closer to the ventral or belly side of the fish, and the ovaries or reproductive organs in the female are closer to the axial skeleton or the vertebral column. And our specimen was snugly tucked in right against the vertebral column just behind the trunk shield. And third was, of course, the mineralized feeding structure, what we believe is the mineralized umbilicus or placental structure. So those three pieces of evidence make a convincing argument that this is indeed an embryo within the mother rather than an ingested food item.
So it's the oldest mother and the oldest example of fish sex.
Well, it's the oldest vertebrate mother we know of. The previous oldest examples of viviparity or live birth with embryos inside the mother actually date back to the Mesozoic era and are found in marine reptiles like ichthyosaurs and mosasaurs. And they're about 200 million years old, the ichthyosaurs. So this pushes it back by almost another 200 million years or so. And in terms of sex, we knew primitively fish spawn in the water, but to have internal fertilization is something that modern sharks and stingrays and chimaerids do, and to find it in placoderms actually pushes that back to the origin of this kind of reproduction as well.
So what's it like for you to realize that you've just pushed the boundaries of paleontology back 200 million years?
Oh, look, it's just a fabulous... It's one of those grand eureka moments you have probably once in your career. I mean, I've described many species of extinct animals. I'm up to about 60 now, including, you know, dinosaurs and fish and so on. But when you find something about the life, the biology of an extinct animal, it really makes you go weak at the knees. It's sort of a big discovery in paleontology because it is so rare.
Dr. Long, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Dr. John Long is the head of science at the Museum Victoria in Melbourne, Australia. Coming up next, clothes make the bird. When Billy Crystal on Saturday Night Live said, "Darling, it's better to look good than feel good," he may have been onto something. At least that could be the case if he'd been talking about barn swallows. In barn swallows, like in most other creatures, it's the good-looking males that get the mates. Like the deer with the biggest antlers or the peacock with the showiest tail, being a handsome boy barn swallow means you're going to get more girls. We do it too, of course. For some, it's gold chains and cologne. For others, it's fast cars and Armani suits. But looking good may have a more important effect than we ever thought. It could be that a boost to our looks may actually improve our health. That's what Dr. Rebecca Safran has been looking at in barn swallows. She's an assistant professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and she's found that looks go more than skin deep. Dr. Safran, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you for having me.
I haven't been in a barn recently, so what does a barn swallow look like?
Barn swallows are a songbird, and they are gorgeous. They have on their front of their bodies these elaborately rusty-colored plumages, and extending from their tails, they have elongated tail streamers that are also very showy and ornamental.
Now, before your work, what was the standard idea about the relationship between a bird's appearance and its body chemistry?
Previous to our research, the prevailing accepted view was that a male's physiological condition, his health status, was a predictor of his appearance.
Okay, so if he's healthy, he looks good? Is that the idea?
If he's healthy, he looks good.
Ah, so if a barn swallow is healthy, then what's he going to look like?
The healthy males are darker in coloration in North American populations, but interestingly, the healthier males have elongated tail streamers in European populations. And so sort of the currency of health is a little bit different depending on where you're studying barn swallows.
Now, why was this original idea that the physical fitness of the bird influences its appearance so important?
Well, in terms of evolutionary fitness, that is the number of genes a male transmits to future generations, what we're trying to understand is how these traits are signaling a male's quality. And the prevailing view is that it's only the top males, the males in the best physical condition, that can afford to create and express these really showy traits.
Now, why did you think this might not be the whole story?
Well, interestingly, if you think about physical fitness and indicators of health, you know, it's intuitive that these variables are highly dynamic. You yourself have a cold today, but yesterday maybe you were feeling better. And so all of these metrics are highly dynamic. And so it's intuitive to think that there might be more going on in terms of a more dynamic relationship between a male's physiological condition and his morphological appearance.
You mean birds can have on days and off days?
Absolutely. Birds pick up parasitic infections. They get into fights, and so their appearance gets scuffled. All sorts of things can affect a bird's physical fitness in addition to its appearance, similar to humans.
So how'd you go about looking to see if there was something else going on?
Well, the interesting thing is that we uncovered a clear relationship between a male's color and his physical fitness and genetic fitness a few years ago, and we wanted to figure out why does that result hold. And so what we wanted to do is manipulate a male's feather color to look like the top male in our population and try and understand, first of all, what is the relationship between condition and appearance, and also to see if there's a more dynamic relationship than was previously appreciated.
So what did you do to the bird?
So all of our studies are conducted in wild populations, and at the start of the breeding season, we caught about 60 males across 2 years. About half of them, we enhanced their feather color to match the darkest male in our population with the simple application of a non-toxic permanent ink marker. All of these males were given a blood test to look at their hormone levels, and then we recaptured these males a week later. What we found is that males whose color we did not enhance simply lost testosterone, which is predicted by the seasonal decline in this androgen. But most surprising, what we found after just 1 week is that males whose feather color we enhanced gained testosterone. This is really surprising because, again, this is a time in the season when males' testosterone levels are usually declining.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying that you painted these birds darker, which makes them look more fit than they really are. And just by doing that, a week later, their testosterone levels were higher.
Exactly. We made these males look like the top males in our population. And yes, within 1 week, their physiology accommodated to their new color,
wow,
to their newfound status.
What went through your mind when you saw that?
Well, it was pretty mind-blowing. We do have this relationship between testosterone and color that naturally exists in our population. That is that darker males naturally have higher levels of testosterone. And so the results that you can simply apply a coat of color to a given male and see that his testosterone levels also accommodate this were really surprising. It first demonstrates that there's a very causal and clear relationship between these hormones and a male's appearance. And the second thing it suggests is that there's this really dynamic relationship between a male's appearance and his physiology, much more so than has been appreciated.
It just reminds me, you know, you put on a nice suit, you really feel good. That this is quite, it's more than feel good. You actually are better. Is that what's happening?
Absolutely. Here? I mean, it's just as you said, you know, beauty is more than skin deep. It's actually backed up by a lot of physiological variables. And it depends on the company you're keeping. So your status is always something that's dynamic. You can look like a top male in one crowd, and yet in another you might be more of a submissive male because your color is always relative to those around you, if we're talking about barn swallows.
Now, if their testosterone levels went up, though, on these birds that you painted, would you say that they were actually more physically fit?
Well, that's a hard leap to make. What we can say is that these males' physiology was accommodating to their newfound appearance. How that's mediated is still a mystery. It could simply mean that these males were detected as cheaters. In other words, other males in the population may simply have said, "Hey, Fred, you know, nice try, and you know, we're gonna engage in more fights with you because we think that this signal is actually something that you've been cheating. This is something that's not backed up by other aspects of your physiology." This increase in testosterone could be a function of more females paying attention to these newly darkened males. And this is the hypothesis that we suspect is probably supported by the data, because in a previous experiment where we increased a male's color, these males with darkened feathers received more genetic mating success than did males whose coloration we didn't enhance.
Oh, so not only did the birds look better and that had an effect, but if they got a compliment, that fluffed them up as well.
You bet.
Did you try coloring the females?
We have not tried coloring females yet, but I have a new graduate student who is coming to set up those experiments next summer.
Interesting to see what happens. Dr. Safran, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Rebecca Safran is an assistant professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And that's it for this week's edition of Quirks and Quarks. But before we go, a reminder to our listeners in friendly Manitoba. We'll be in Winnipeg this Thursday, June 10th, with the Quirks Question Roadshow. We'll be at the Prairie Theatre Exchange at 7:30 p.m. to record the show, and you're invited. Find out why cats can see in the dark, why drunks see double, and other fascinating science questions. It's a fun evening of good science and good music. The event is free, so get there early for a good seat. That's the Quirks Question Roadshow this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Prairie Theatre Exchange in Winnipeg. And you'll hear that show next week on Quirks and Quarks. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can write to Quirks and Quarks, P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, Ontario, M5W1E6. Our email is quirks@cbc.ca. And to get to our webpage, just go to cbc.ca/quirks, where you can subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our weekly newsletter, listen to our audio archives, and check out our latest blog. Quirks and Quarks was produced by Jim Hanman, Jim Lebbins, Pat Sensen, and Damon Fairless, with technical help from Tim Lorimer. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.